thank you. I don't know really how to express how much pleasure it gives me to be here today. For a while in America, not because anything would have happened to me, but I really didn't know whether I would ever get back here again. 2.5 years ago, or a little more than that, I had the pleasure of being invited by some British Scientologists to come over here and give a few lectures. When I came over here, I found something very amazing. I had never before been to England. I had seen the coast of England during the war, but I had never before been in England. And I found a very pleasant and a very friendly country. And after the hectic turmoil of 2 years, 3 years of Dianetics and its organizations in the United States, this looked very peaceful to me. My time track, you know, most everyone has a time track in which the moments of his lifetime are recorded. And most everyone's time track goes on a basis of you eat and you sleep and you fall in love and you get shot at and other minor incidents. And it hasn't been so minor around the world here in the last few years, has it? And it all adds together in what we call a time track. Incidents recorded. Well, I had a time track in 1948, but by 1952, when I first came to England, I didn't have a time track anymore. I had a consecutive series of crises. What with the enthusiasm of America for Dianetics and the enthusiasm of the AMA for no Dianetics, we were running a sufficient dichotomy of opposites to make the situation at least interesting. And after a short time, I decided this was going to be a very hectic war, and up to 1952, it was. And then I came over to England. I found people friendly, and I found sane Dianeticists. Now, you know, it's quite something. It's quite something to be going around telling people that we have the answer to sanity and then find a bunch of people who are sane. We're still interested in the subject. And the remarkable thing of it was that everybody was willing to pull together to make Dianetics a very fine thing in this country. Of course, by that time, we also had Scientology. Slight difference between these two things. Dianetics is really a psychotherapy. It, you might say, ends track on the subject of psychotherapy. And I do mean that because psychotherapy is an effort to remove neurosis and psychosis from man by immediate address to the individual and the group. But it assumes and has to assume that there is neurosis and psychosis there. Scientology is different. Scientology assumes something else. It assumes that every man can be more able than he is, and then goes ahead with very precise techniques to make him so. Well, the British friends I had here, and I got to work, and we built an organization called the Hubbard Association of Scientologists. The response to that organization was very good. And the purpose of the organization was simply to have a central point of dissemination where the materials of Dianetics and Scientology could be put out without any great turmoil, turbulence, vias. And to train people in the subject who wanted training, and to give people help and information who wanted help and information. That was what the HAS was formed to do, and it went evenly upon its way. Now, having had the experience of America, you know, nothing is small in America. There's nothing small in the whole country. The science of biology there is made very easy because the microbes are 8 feet long. And every time we would attempt in America to build an organization, it had to be 3 times as big as it should have been, you see. So we didn't work that way in Great Britain. We built the organization barely as big as it had to be to do the job of the moment. And that is actually the operating policy today of the HAS. There is really no other operating policy as far as the organization itself is concerned. Build it as big as it has to be to do the job of the moment. Now, what has been the job of this organization? It's been to hold together, one way or the other, the persons interested in Dianetics and Scientology, and to maintain a good public bill of health for the sciences themselves. And what do you know? I have the great pleasure of returning here and discovering, after all this time, that the good people of the HAS have managed to hold together and maintain the best of their ability the good public repute of the HAS. And I'd like to take this opportunity to thank those people right now. Our problems have been very great. The problems of finance in Dianetics and Scientology are peculiar ones, and very often the public at large believes these policies are less than optimum, to say the least. But nothing like this ever happened before. Nothing like this has ever happened before. A body of knowledge has arisen, has been codified, has been tested, which does certain specific and spectacular things, which does not belong lock, stock, and barrel to any vested interest in the world. This is fantastic. This has never occurred before. Dianetics and Scientology today are free. They have no commitments. The organizations have no commitments. Because the research and development was done with the finance and the assistance of the people of the organizations themselves. There was no huge subsidy. It's interesting that the first organization of Dianetics in the United States, the Hubbard Dianetic Research Foundation, was founded practically in the same week that one of the largest mental research organizations of the world was founded. In the same week, these two organizations were founded. One was the Ford Foundation, and the other was the Hubbard Dianetic Research Foundation. And the Ford Foundation had so many uncounted millions at its fingertips, given to it by the Ford Motor Company and other interests, that it had a terrible time trying to spend money. The interest on the stocks and bonds which it had been given was so great that they could not invent enough projects to do anything. Poor people. I've certainly never been in that position. and we find the HDRF and the HAS all these years later just about as solvent as they ought to be, and the whole trunk load of answers sitting there available. There's something to be said then for freedom. There's something to be said for an enterprise and an activity which is done by its own people on their own finance and with their own will to win, and not because somebody is paying them a fast salary. We've had very lean times. We've had moments when I didn't know whether or not the bills of the organization could be paid. But always, somehow, somewhere, we've managed to work a little harder, just as the good people at Dianetics Scientology have managed to work a little harder, find a couple of more crowns. It's just about the way it's run. And the end result is that the people of the world, represented by the people in Dianetics and Scientology, own this whole trunk full of material which can resolve the problems relating to the human mind. Thank you. What would happen today if the Ford Foundation or some other organization had handed into my hands or the hands of the organization some huge sum of money and had said, here now, here we go? We would be here today knowing nothing about organizations, and probably 75% of the material which we have amassed would not be present. There's a difference between doing things with a pound and doing them with a will. And not all the money in Christendom could buy the wisdom of Dianetics and Scientology. Yeah. It might amaze you the number of offers which have been made for the totality of research materials of Dianetics and Scientology. Might amaze you. The first offer was made when the first, earliest beginnings of the subject were underway, 1938. It was hardly anything at all. All I had done was speculate a little bit, and I had made a few pen scratches on a piece of paper, speculating whether or not the mind was a solvable problem. And I'd come up with a few conclusions that it was a solvable problem. The first I heard of that was $100,000 offered me for my existing manuscripts by the Union of Soviet Socialist States of Russia. That was the first bit. They offered me $100,000, a good laboratory outside of Moscow, I'm a member of the Explorers Club, New York City, by virtue of going around to some of the less frequented places in the world where they where the cigarettes are few and the plumbing is terrible. And for this hardship, I became a member of the Explorers Club back in the mid-30s. And there was a chap there by the name of Glinsky, and he heard from some of my friends that I could outwitch doctor a witch doctor or two. And he inquired into this further and found out there were some manuscripts, and evidently he was in touch with Moscow. And the next thing you know, I was sitting down to tea at the Explorers Club long table, and this fellow slid into the chair alongside me and confidentially said, could you use $100,000 Well, the answer, of course, was no. And as the years went on, research and investigation interrupted by the war was resumed immediately after the war in the Oak Knoll Naval Hospital, where I studied endocrinology, the endocrine systems and glands and so forth. There's some virtue in studying something without benefit of diploma or grades, and when nobody knows you've been studying them. I was a line officer in the Navy, not a staff corps officer. And the difference in the U.S. Navy between a line officer and a staff corps officer is a line officer wears his bars or leaves on his uniform collar, both sides. And a staff officer wears them only on one side. We do owe a slight debt of gratitude to the United States Navy Medical Department. Only they don't know it. I went down. I wanted to look up some things about the mind and the endocrine system, the body, and so on, down in the medical library. They had a huge medical library, and I'd been shipped up there and put on the shelf in early 1944 as a casualty, and I was supposed to stand by and be surveyed to retirement and so on. I was there a year before I got out of there. There was nothing wrong with me. I kept insisting, but pure cussedness, but they kept pointing to the bandages I was still wearing and so forth. And so there wasn't anything I could do. You know, when a government says, well, now this is exactly your position and location, why, you very often stay there. So, to while away the time, decided I would study a little bit about medicine. As I say, they had a huge medical library, and were carrying on at that time research programs concerning the endocrine system. We were getting people who had been starved, pilots shot down and afloat for weeks at sea and so forth, and they were trying to find out what made people eat and what didn't make them eat, so they could put these pilots back into some shape again, and other people. And I went down, and they said, looking at these two collar ornaments, they said, "I'm sorry, doctors only." Of course, all the doctor I was a doctor of engineering. I didn't count around there. I was not a member of the club. And furthermore, I was patient. So I was patient and waited until the watch changed and the librarian, whose memory I hoped would be fleeting, went off duty and another librarian came on duty. I took off one of my collar ornaments and smoothed out the pin marks in it and found a Marine who was hobbling along on crutches. And I said, "How would you like to make a fast buck, Leatherneck?" And he says, "Sure, absolutely." So I said, "I will be standing in at that desk in about 30 seconds, and I want you to hobble by and say, 'How are you, doctor?'" So anyway, with the tremendous research facilities of the United States Navy at my disposal, how could I miss? And we are indebted to that period of research just for this reason only. We learned whether it was function or structure that monitored human condition. That's an interesting question, come to think about it, because the question hasn't been asked for I don't know how long. Now, most everybody says it's structure. The reason this man is unhappy is he has a pain in his leg, and it makes him unhappy. and his mental condition depends exclusively upon his physical condition. His mental condition depends upon the balance of hormones in his system, his glandular fluids, his diet, his environment. And this determines his mental condition. He becomes mentally afraid because he starts to run. And that was the philosophy of healing as of 1945. An interesting philosophy. Well, was it right? Much earlier in my life, I'd had the privilege of studying under someone taught by Sigmund Freud himself. And Sigmund Freud had the idea that maybe the mind had something to do with it, but we couldn't be too sure. There were no scientific proofs sitting there. So actually, for the rest of that year, completely aside from going down to Hollywood a few hundred miles south of there and seeing my old friends and doing other things like that, which are, of course, at the time, usually more important, studied this problem to resolve this question. Is it structure that monitors the mind, or the mind that monitors structure? And if we come up here with a decision either way, we will study that side of it. And what do you know? With the vast, laborious, wonderful, but unwitting assistance of the research projects then running, we got the answer. We got the answer in this way. Here is an individual who cannot accept the male hormone. That is to say, his virility is gone. Male hormone cannot accept it. That is to say, we give it to him and his virility remains the same. You must understand that men under tremendous stress very often lose their virility. All right, could he then be changed in some way so that the male hormone would be effective in him? An injection or administration of this drug. Would that then be effective? If we changed his mind. Here we have the path back that the male hormone did not affect this person. Vast studies demonstrated that. They did not change his health. A man, by the way, cannot eat or break down food if he is too short on this vital thing called testosterone. And in trying to make men eat, they were experimenting with testosterone. It sounds odd that they would use this hormone. Actually, it's not a sex hormone. It's simply a body hormone. Now, here we had then a wonderful open and shut question, which if answered, would tell us whether or not the mind monitored the body or the body monitored the mind. So, sitting around on benches in the park there at the hospital, sitting down alongside of some of these chaps who obviously were starved half to death, they were very easy to recognize, tremendous and terrible privations they'd suffered one way or the other, I started to work on them what little I knew, as clumsily as I knew it, Freudian analysis. Well, it's a clumsy tool. But talk to them about this and that. And get them to change their minds about life or about sex. And then, after hours, walk into the office of the research projects, which were actually examining this man, and find his papers. Isn't that covert? And on a series of several of these cases, which could not accept this glandular fluid or use it, psychotherapy worked. All we had to do was just get him to change his mind vaguely on the subject. Just better him a tiny little bit. And all of a sudden, we had a hormone going to work. Well, what on earth here? What on earth were we looking at? Nothing that could be done to him physically was changing his mind. But we did something to him mentally, and we changed his body structure so he then ate and got well and resumed the normal activities of a man. Took a year to establish that. And after that, it was easy. It was easy because we knew something that nearly all of us are unaware that we know, since we know it so well today. And that is that the mind monitors structure, and that structure can only modify the mind. You can get a kickback from structure which will change somebody's mind. Believe me, you can change somebody's mind out here by breaking his leg. That's certain. He has the idea that he has a well leg, and now he's got the idea he has a broken leg, and he doesn't like it, but we've certainly changed his mind. But let's look at the other side of this. By breaking his leg or doing something to his leg, could we put him into a higher intelligence bracket? Could we make him more successful in handling his boss? Could we make it possible for him to ride a motorcycle better? Could we? There isn't a single thing we could do to his leg that would alter these characteristics. And quite on the contrary, if he's bound and determined that that leg won't heal, it won't heal. If he's just sat there and says, no healing. Well, this puts us on a different vector than man has been on during these many last millennia. On a different vector. It tells us that all those things we have considered good about man, such as his ethics, his friendliness, his skill, his talent, are the best of men. And when these things are in bad condition, the man is in bad condition. And he could be in the most wonderful physical condition you ever saw in your life. And it wouldn't do a single thing for his ethics or his talent or his morals. But he could be in terrible physical condition and still be very able mentally. But if he were very able mentally, he could turn around and change his physical structure. And thus you and I are not left in the position of fumbling and floundering with regard to our intentions and how we go about it. When we see somebody who is sick, we know that we can do something about it because we can communicate to the man and he can communicate to and vanquish the sickness. Now, men have suspected this before, but nobody'd ever come up with an open and shut proof of the matter. Just a hammer on the anvil proof. That's that. And that was what launched us into Dianetics and later into Scientology. A proof, a continuous demonstration of these conditions. Man might have suspected it, but man didn't know it. And we know now that we know it. Too many times entirely, we have been discouraged, however, by reluctant, recalcitrant, ornery, cussed, mean guys that just refuse to cooperate with us and get well. What do you know? We just have to assume, then, that there must be some intention not to be well kicking around, too. We just have to assume that. We don't immediately assume, then, you see, that the mind is not, in this man, in control of the structure. We don't assume that. That would be idiocy. We merely assume that he decided to control the structure in some other direction. And if there were any people present who had never at any time desired to be ill, of course, this question would be thrown into doubt. But I think there's possibly a few people present who at one time or another have desired to be ill, have found illness to be a good answer. And you sit there right now and you say to me, well, no, I never did. How about staying home from school? So the mind can monitor structure so thoroughly that it can make it sick or well. That's what we infer from this. But of course, there's the fellow who apparently wants to get well, but who is sick. And we work with him. We try to do something for him. And he sits there and breaks our hearts saying, nothing's happening, nothing's happening, nothing's happening. And we process him for another 30 hours. Nothing's happening, nothing's happening. He just woke up the other day. What was wrong with this fellow? Nothing's happening. That's what's wrong with him. Made a test of this. I got one of these chaps in, and I asked him, just on straight recall processes, what? Have you any times in your life when you decided nothing was happening? Oh, yes, he says. I decide that all the time. And we changed his mind on this score, and then he changed. Now, one of the great difficulties we run into in agreement with this society at this time is that people think that people ought to live only. Now, that sounds like an odd difficulty, but it is a difficulty. People only think people ought to live. Nobody ought to die. See, they don't have this in mind. Whereas the mind itself, in its operations, considers both of these activities. It considers livingness and dyingness. And some data that we have gives us to believe, and it's a little bit more than a suspicion, that the body abilities and beingness does not happen to quit living just because it dies as a particular identity. Something else happens. It goes on up the track. Now, if we look at an individual's, of course, this we could argue about this for a long time, since nobody here at the moment has died a couple of days ago and is here in another body, you see, that he recalls. But that could happen, too. Anyway, our question here is whether or not a body dies or, again, dies to live. Could it be possible for a body to die to live? Yes, it could. Very possible. Supposing, let's take the case of the brontosaurus. And he lived in an area where there were lots of trees, and he ate the tops of the trees, one of these huge prehistoric beasts. And he ate the tops of the trees, and after a while there were no treetops. He was in a pickle, wasn't he? Now the question is, did the brontosaurus simply stop living entirely, or pick up a more workable, as we call it, mock-up? Which did he do? Well, we don't have any brontosaurus here to testify. But we can speculate. He altered and modified his form in another lifetime. Now look, if you didn't have any means of altering your form at all, you would be in terrible condition. You know, you'd be going around with teeth clear out here and that long, huh? Girls wouldn't like you. So, we could take a look at Darwinian evolution, which, by the way, is awfully offbeat. That it's not hip. The reason it's not hip is it assumes it's all by accident. It's what's known as living by accidents. It assumes that by a happy accident, a life form decided to modify itself. But it didn't decide at all. It was just a happy accident that it did. And that enough happy accidents occurred so that you are now in the form you're in. Well, this is all very well for a biologist, but not for a mathematician, because we start laying out how many happy accidents there'd have to be simultaneously, and we find that actuarially and mathematically it's an impossibility for this many accidents to have occurred to make a complete uniform and standard form. If you notice, the form of one man is quite like the form of another man. Well, this is an accident itself, which is completely unexplainable by accident. Somebody must have decided this sometime or another. Somebody decided, you probably did. You know? He said, we'll look somewhat alike, and then we'll know each other, and we'll be men, and we'll eat chickens. But let me point out to you that the Darwin theory assumes, if you please, without stating it at all, reincarnation. And a scientist hearing this deeply in Darwinian theory and biology would say, eek! This is horrible. No, it's not like that at all. What it is, there's an unending stream of protoplasm that comes up the time track. And bodies are all made off of it. Last time a chap in a university told me this, about this unending stream of protoplasm, I offered to buy some. They didn't have any for sale. Not a single bit of it. So, what greater idiocy would there be than this? Well, of course, we could assume that it's just cell to cell to cell to cell, and it comes up the track very neatly and goes along very nicely, except when we begin to investigate the pasts of people, and when we take an electropsychometer to people, and when we start testing their responses one way or the other, we find out that a body, when it died, didn't stay there in the graveyard. All the material of the body, the calcium, everything else, evidently stayed there in the graveyard, see? And this fellow said, outward bound. Now let's see. We got to pick up some more calcium and so forth. I'm going to put together. And this time, we will put it together so when it's 50 years old, boy, will it look awfully stern and mean. We have to allow some sort of intention going on like that. Well, of course, that's all highly speculative, but I don't see why we shouldn't at least mention it, for the good reason that man has been shooting man over this question for some thousands of years. In the Roman Empire, it was nothing, you know, to have somebody tap you on the shoulder there 4 or 5 centuries A.D. and say, brother, I called him brother then, not comrade. They said, brother, have you been properly baptized so that when you die you will go to heaven? And the fellow says, no, I ain't been baptized. And they'd ruin him. His political future was just wrecked. But of course, nobody has been arguing about or believes in this matter of reincarnation. Nobody believes that at all. Because it's probably the truth. Man being kind of perverse about the whole thing would probably rather believe a lie than the truth. But anyway, for our purposes, right straight down along the line, we have to assume that the form gets rid of itself in order to construct a more workable form. Now, just why it goes to all this trouble, we won't bother to question, since it would be much easier, right in a lifetime, to grow the third eye or the fifth foot or whatever you thought you needed, you know, to make a successful run of it. But that's a very unconservative, a radical sort of thing to do. People would be discouraged from this. You walk downstairs for breakfast and you went to bed with two eyes and you wake up with three. And your wife would be upset. And probably if there were war on or something, why, people would have to investigate your ration card to make sure it was the right man, and all kinds of things would happen, you know, and it would be confusing. So obviously, maybe the best thing to do is to kick off the mock-up and build another one. Maybe that's the best thing to do. But certainly, it would be create less confusion if we did it that way. So is there very possibly something like that's going on? And I call to your mind, I'm talking about a theory that's about 100 years old and is taught in every university in the country, the Darwinian theory, which is unworkably explained. But nevertheless, it says that life forms go on making mock-ups. And they don't just perish and forget how. See? So therefore, there would be a technology of dyingness in the mind, too. And a lot of writers have talked about this. Schopenhauer's talked about this, the will and the idea. The death wish, more or less, where we got this idea about the death wish. Somebody wants to die, and he tries to knock off the mock-up one way or the other. Well, sometimes he decided to die, and then decided he didn't want to die, and then decided to live without undeciding that he was going to die. That's an interesting thing, isn't it? Well, we could call that a psychosomatic illness or a chronic somatic. He made up his mind. He was going to chuck the whole thing. He said, this is not a workable mock-up. This is not workable. This girl said, here I am, 22 years old, and I haven't been whistled at once. Dickens with this mock-up. Chuck it out. So she said, she says this below the level of complete awareness, you know, and sometimes right above the level of complete awareness, I could just die. She doesn't say it accidentally. She means that I better get another mock-up. And if I could just knock off this mock-up, I could then build another one. And away we go. And boy, this next one I build, is it going to be a hussy? Well, very often, she decides to chuck the whole thing. She's going to live dangerously. She's going to be in a motorcycle accident if she can possibly manage it. So she finds a guy that has a motorcycle who rides recklessly. And she buys herself a cute hat. And careful not to buy a hat that will prevent skull concussion. And gets on the back of the motorcycle, and away they go. And then nags him and gets him emotionally upset. And one of these days, she's going to get a chance to build a new mock-up. Well, she decides all this, you see, and she gets to be about 23, and she's got this all programmed, you know. She's going to go by the board, zoom, and she's going to build another mock-up. We'll just say that's what she's doing. And fellow whistles at her. He's gone to the age of 22, decided to get another mock-up because nobody whistled at her, and now 23 and somebody whistles at her. And she meets a guy or six, and they say, boy, some babe. And she says, huh? She begins to develop her walk. In fact, she begins to develop. Then when she's 26, she's gotten married, and her husband is upset with her about something. And he says, do you have to go to bed with those curlers on every night? So I'm displeasing him. He doesn't like this mock-up. She doesn't now decide to kick it off. She already decided that when she was 22. She starts to go to pieces physically. She's got a decision to die and a decision to live, and then somebody who would like her to make a decision to die. This compounds a felony, and she all of a sudden gets adenoids or something. See, she starts to knock off the mock-up right there. And she says, but I am not knocking it off. I'm not doing this. There's something else doing it. Yeah, there sure is. There's the past doing it. See? But she did it in the past. So somebody comes along and said, you're doing it. And she says, no, I'm not doing it. That's the truth. If somebody said to her, you were doing it, or you did it, and you are now doing something else, and you're living in a conflict, she says, mm-mm. No, I'm not. I want to live. I have to put my hair up in curlers. So she goes to a psychoanalyst who sits there. He says, do you have dreams? And she says, yes, as a matter of fact, I do. I dreamed last night that I was frying chicken. Oh. Serious case. Well, it's obvious to me that you had an affair when you were 4. And that your fixation and upon your father and your jealousy for your mother brings about a condition of ipsilicious swishes. She goes away, she's no better off at all. In fact, she's worse because it cost her 2 guineas. And now she can find something new. She finds she can be a professional invalid or a professional neurotic or something. She says, this is not too undesirable. I was never before able to make him bring me a cup of tea in bed in the morning. And now he brings me a cup of tea in bed in the morning. Furthermore, he used to get mad, and now because of my condition, he doesn't dare get mad, so I'm not too bad off. I don't want the mock-up, I do want the mock-up, but I don't want the mock-up, but while I've got it, I can certainly raise hell with a lot of people. You ever run into anybody like that? Huh? You ever run into anybody like that? Well, the basic data on the case is this: survive, destroy. She wanted to survive. She's trying to destroy herself so that she can survive. And in neither case has she completely made up her mind. Is she going to live or is she going to die? She decided to live without undeciding she was going to die. She decided to die without undeciding she was going to live. And so she hangs halfway between. And so we have learned a great deal about man. Because you take factors of this character and you start to work with this man or this woman or this soldier, and the weirdest things happen. They suddenly straighten out and make up their minds either way. And fortunately for us, they usually make up their minds to survive. But when they've made up their mind to survive, they discover, and it can be discovered in them, that their intelligence can be raised as much as 30 to 40 points. Fantastic. A man of 86 has no right to have his intelligence raised from 105 to 167. It just happened over in the States. Now he's happy and he's all set and he'll let the mock-up go on or disintegrate or do what it wants to do gracefully and he can live. But he had decided to die and decided to live so often in so many directions that he didn't know what he wanted to do. And it took about 3 weeks of work with the center over there to straighten him out. Let him find out what he was doing. Got it? He had to find out what he was doing. And this is what he found out, and so he straightened it out. Well, we have carried forward then from small results, but better than man had before. Small organizations that were no bigger than they had to be, such as the British organization, up to a point where we've got a good, sound, functioning organization, which is financially very capable. That is to say, it's paid its bills. It doesn't have thousands and millions of pounds, but it's paid its bills. It can carry along, do what it's supposed to do. And more important than that, we have processes today. We have processes today with which we could absolutely rely upon raising somebody's intelligence as much as 30 to 40 points. That sounds fantastic, isn't it? And we could certainly straighten them out so they could decide whether they wanted to die or wanted to live. And if they were not acutely ill, we could do a great deal for them. We don't know any cases too far south if they are simply mediumly well and not acutely ill or completely insane. Well, that's far south. That's merely because there's hardly any person there at all. But not given that, we have hit pretty much rock bottom. We can take any of the cases now in Great Britain who are having difficulty before in auditing, we can straighten them out. We can straighten out any organizational problem that we have, even though some of them might appear greater to you than they do to me. We have then arrived. We have arrived here in Great Britain. We can do what we say we can do. It means a better life for an awful lot of people. A much better life. We've not only arrived, we've arrived without being owned. We've arrived with nobody to say us nay about how we use what we know. We don't have to use what we know to sell this or that, or push this, or push that. We don't have to repress a paragraph here and a book there. We can say anything we know. And because we ourselves, you, me, people in the organizations, can say what we want to say and use this material any way that we think it should be used, it will then be used for greater freedom and for an all-out advance on mankind. And that's why I'm here. Thank you.